This is a No Dabba podcast. I'm Brian Hogan, and this evening I'm joined by Michael Brett, CEO of QBranch, a company applying quantum computing to data analytics. Michael, thank you very much for joining me.
It's great to be here, Brian. Thanks for having me.
So to start off, can you tell me a little bit about yourself, please?
Yeah, sure thing. So I'm an Australian living in Washington, D.C. I moved to the States about 5 years ago and with some co-founders started this company. My background is aerospace engineering, and in particular working on software and modeling and simulation systems in the aerospace world. One of my first jobs was building a modeling and simulation system that would predict where rockets would land. And so I got heavily involved in predictive analytics and forecasting type work and looking at the mathematics behind things like Monte Carlo simulations and how to make good quality predictions about very complex systems and uncertain events.
I suppose that was all with traditional processors and computing at the time?
Yeah, exactly right. So making the best we could of, I think even before cloud computing, we were sort of building our own private clouds and running as many simulations as we could on the hardware that we had available to us.
So then what is QBranch? What's its history?
Yeah, so QBranch is a data analytics company. We were co-founded by a group of people that had worked together for a long time in the aerospace sector. And what we saw was an opportunity to transition some of our skills and capabilities in the aerospace domain across to much more commercially interesting activities. So we decided to set up a company about 4 years ago now to look at predictive analytics as a business area and see if we could apply some of that modeling and simulation work to things like finance and insurance and customer behavior. And so QBranch is headquartered in Washington, D.C., sort of as a connection back to our aerospace and defense days. We've got a team based in Adelaide, Australia, and a team based in London in the U.K.
And is it mainly finance, or are you not restricted to just finance? Because when I came across your company initially, it was finance was a big part of it.
Yeah, finance is a big part of our business. It's probably the sector that has been the highest traction for us in the early days of the company. One of the things that we did in the very early stages of the business, we were selected for a startup incubator program called the FinTech Innovation Lab that was run by Accenture. And that program introduced us to essentially our first customers. So even right from the beginning, we were kind of thrust into the financial world, and just through connectivity in that space, we got our start, and it's kind of built from there, working in the financial sector. But we work across all sorts of different businesses, work in pharmaceuticals and oil and gas and other technology companies generally. So the kind of work that we do in data analytics, it's not that specific to any particular domain. It's probabilistic forecasting type work. And so we're keen to build up the business across many different sectors and apply that domain expertise from our customers to the models that we build.
So we will come back a little bit to the applications, but for someone who doesn't know anything about it, what is quantum computing? Without having to go into too much depth.
So quantum computing is a really exciting emerging technology. And one of the ways that I describe it is that we know that over the past 50 years or so, we've been writing Moore's Law as a way to increase the power and capabilities of computer chips over time. And we've kind of got used to this essentially doubling of power of computer chips every 18 months or so throughout all of our lifetimes as we entered the computer age. And one of the ways that Moore's Law progresses is in cramming more and more transistors onto the same space. So Intel and companies that build integrated circuits like cram more and more transistors onto that space. And so transistors are getting smaller and smaller over time. And we're starting to reach the fundamental limit of how small you can possibly make a transistor to go into a classical computer chip. And that fundamental limit is the limit of matter itself, which is the size of atoms, and ensuring that there are indeed enough atoms on the transistor to have enough electrons to get the right kind of current flow across that gap. And so that's why over the last few years we've seen predictions of Moore's Law running out, and companies like Intel creating different techniques to keep up with the pace that's necessary for increasing speeds in computing. And so that's in the classical computing world, hitting that fundamental limit. And what quantum computing is saying, well, what if we go beyond that limit? What if we don't restrict ourselves to the behavior of classical mechanics and the kind of the traditional approach to building a computer, and instead effectively go inside the atom and go to the next layer down and look inside the quantum mechanical world. So the behavior and interactions that go on at the subatomic level, which is a very strange and unusual place, and there are some very unique phenomena that go on there that's counterintuitive to us that live in the macro environment and the classical environment. But that behavior, if we could harness it, allows us to do a different kind of mathematics and a different kind of computational work if we can build a computer that supports that. And so that's what quantum computing is. It's using that strange behavior at that level to do computational work for us. And the trick to building a quantum computer is being able to write to and read from and allow interactions that go on at that scale, and to be able to control it and work with that as a physical construct. And so what we've seen over the past couple of years is some tremendous breakthroughs and progress in building systems that can indeed control that environment and do computational work. And that's incredibly exciting for us because it opens up a whole new world of possibilities for doing computer science with a different kind of mathematics than what we're used to.
So I've made two podcasts in the last year, one with Jay Gambetta of IBM about their quantum computer, and previously with Michael Birsik about quantum computing in general. So if listeners want to hear more, they can certainly listen to those. But as a bizarre coincidence, you're another Australian living in America working on quantum. Jay is an Australian living in America working on quantum, and Michael is the American living in Australia. Is there something about the connection with Australia and quantum computing?
There is something about Australian quantum computing. Australia and the research universities there have a tremendous track record in quantum information science going back 20, 30 years. And it's been one of those virtuous cycles where some early breakthroughs in quantum computing and some work by some extremely talented scientists in Australia has led to more funding, which has led to more research, which has led to more breakthroughs, which has led to more funding, and so on. And fast forward to today, Australia and in particular the universities there have an incredible capability and background in quantum information science. And we're seeing some just tremendous talent coming out of there, some really remarkable world-leading research in Australia, which is helping a relatively small country compete on a global scale in a technology like this. But that's, you know, it is a very competitive space globally. There's some really incredible talent in the US and the UK and Canada, the Netherlands and Austria, and also in Asia, that, you know, I think we're gearing up over the next 10 to 20 years for a kind of quantum computing race to create competitive industries out of this. And so as an Australian, I really hope that Australia continues to play a role in that and can take part in that growth and build some world-leading companies. But also as being an Australian in America and our company headquartered here, we definitely want to build the ecosystem in our own backyard as well.
So what is the current state of the technology now? Because When I spoke with Jay, and it was October last year, I think IBM had just released something like a 15 or 16 qubit computer. And the previous time, Michael Biersik, he was talking about maybe up to 20 in the lab. Where are we now?
So this is a really exciting time for this technology. And what we're seeing over the last probably 18 months, 2 years or so, is the transition of a technology from research labs and universities sort of doing the heavy lifting on the science side of things and the research side of things to more corporate R&D and engineering development type work. And so that transition is of a technology from kind of the heavy lifting done on the pure science side to now a lot of activity on the engineering side has led to the creation of complete systems for the first time, rather than sort of scientific driven apparatus for the purposes of driving the art and science of quantum computing. We're now seeing complete systems for driving the engineering and commercial use case of quantum computing. And so we're seeing companies like IBM and Google and Microsoft and Intel building complete systems for the first time and making those available to companies like ours that are interested in the applications that we can run on it. And we're also seeing an incredible amount of investment coming from the venture capital world into startup companies that are building quantum computing hardware as well. And so where we are today, sort of early 2018, is that the systems that are being built and engineered are nowhere near ready for commercial primetime use, but they're becoming very capable and very useful as test beds for software companies to start to explore the applications and the use cases and understand how we're going to benchmark these systems, how we're going to understand performance, what they can do and can't do. And what we need to build is that feedback loop from applications in industry and where the commercial value is of quantum computing, feeding that back to the folks that are building the hardware so that they can make the right design choices about where to go next, you know, more qubits or, you know, better error correction or better control or whatever it is. And then they build the next version of their platform, which allows us to do better benchmarking, which then feeds back into better hardware and get into that loop. And the faster we get into that loop and the more cycles that we can do, the sooner that we'll be able to get quantum computing hardware out into commercial application and widespread adopted use.
You said they're nowhere near ready. So are you talking 5 years, 10 years, 2 years? Where do you think it's going to happen?
Yeah, it's the business of predicting when quantum computing is going to be ready is a very fraught business, and I certainly won't want to stake any particular claim on how far away we are from a cloud services provider like Google or Microsoft having commercial quantum computing in the cloud ready for use with a credit card. But one of the things that we need to do as a community is to find the near-term applications. So those are the applications that are useful in industry, that are commercially valuable, that can operate on computers that are 300, 400, 500 qubits in size, that don't require error correction but can deliver some value to the end user. And if we're successful in doing that, I think we'll see quantum computing released over the next sort of 3 to 5 years that gets that into the very early stages of commercial adoption and creates the return on investment needed to continue to invest and build the next scale up of systems, so the 3,000, 5,000 qubit machines. I think that if we as a community aren't able to show the value at the 300 to 1,000 qubit size, it's going to be very difficult to attract the investment required to build the bigger scale systems and solve some of the big engineering problems that exist at that scale.
So you mentioned there that you think it's probably going to be cloud-based, but the IBMs, the Googles, AWS, Azure and the like. Do you see on-premise quantum computing as a possibility?
Yeah, absolutely. I think the early stage adoption of quantum computing will be in the cloud, and particularly the accessibility of quantum computing will come from cloud services like AWS and Google and Azure and AliCloud. What we already see today is a mixed compute environment in the cloud. We've got CPUs and GPUs and tensor processing units and all manner of different systems that work in the cloud environment. And quantum computing will be just another processor that exists in that cloud. And the cloud environment will help us to build systems to allocate the right algorithm to the right hardware. So if it's better suited to a CPU, we run it on a CPU. If it's better suited to a quantum processing unit, we run it on there. And then allowing all of those different systems to work in a collaborative way as kind of co-processors that apply the right algorithm to the right hardware. And so that cloud compute environment, I think, is the pathway forward for adoption of quantum computing. But for organizations that are bound by regulatory restrictions around the use of the cloud, and so finance is a great example where they need to operate their own internal on-premises cloud systems, they too will need to invest in quantum compute infrastructure that exists on their internal cloud environments. And so that's exactly one of the projects that QBranch has delivered with one of our customers, the Commonwealth Bank of Australia in Sydney. They've got an internal private cloud environment, and we've worked with them to build a quantum computing environment that they can run internally. So it's a simulator of a quantum computer. It runs on classical computers, but it behaves as if it is a quantum computer. And it was really important to deliver that on premises because at a bank where you've got regulatory restrictions and a lot of lockdown about how to access compute infrastructure, for that organization, their internal capability and skills and people, processes, and tools in quantum computing, they need accessibility to that. And accessibility means their own private infrastructure and being able to put their own data on there and use their existing platforms. And so deploying a quantum computing simulation environment into that internal private cloud was an important first step for an organization like CBA to start to build up those skills and understand how quantum computing might impact their business long term.
You mentioned a few moments ago the idea that some jobs are more suitable for quantum and some for classical computing. What's an example of something that is more suitable for quantum computing?
Yeah, so quantum computing will certainly not replace classical computing. There are some things that a quantum computer is incredibly good at and other things that it is not so good at that a classical computer is much better suited for. And so the early applications of quantum computing are likely to be in the areas of optimization type problems, machine learning type problems that are highly probabilistic in nature. So using the inherently probabilistic nature of a quantum computer to help drive machine learning solutions. And the third application being quantum chemistry, which is the simulation of the quantum mechanical environment in nature. So the interactions of molecules and molecular structures, that is a inherently quantum mechanical thing that goes on in our natural world. And one of the best ways to simulate that is to use a quantum computer to simulate that interaction. And so it's an incredibly computationally intensive thing to do in the classical domain because you've got to look at all sorts of interactions that go on that are very difficult to compute. But a quantum computer can be a lot more efficient at doing that, at matching what goes on in the natural world with a quantum computer that's well suited to that.
Your focus, I know it's not exclusively in finance, but if we were to, let's say, talk about the finance industry, would you see quantum computing involved in the likes of high-frequency trading, quantitative analysis, or something else?
So there are there's a surprising number of applications for quantum computing in the financial world, and Some of the ones that we're looking at are in algorithm design for things like optimization problems on portfolio optimization or risk management type problems, which are operations that are an investment bank does today on their private cloud that aren't at all related to high-frequency trading. It's just the business of the bank and supporting compliance activities and that kind of thing. But one of the applications of quantum computing is in helping to assist with building machine learning models and training those models to be optimized to particular scenarios or to reach a solution in the shortest possible time or a threshold of accuracy in the shortest possible time. And so if we're able to use a quantum computer to accelerate the training of machine learning models, that's got a tremendous number of applications in finance, including in the high frequency world. So it's not so much shaving microseconds off a transaction, but building models that are more adaptable, that can learn faster, that can iterate on the environmental changes faster because there's a quantum computer in the background that's helping to find the optimal configuration of a machine learning algorithm. And so that I think is where there's a tremendous amount of opportunity if we're able to build models and systems that allow that co-processing nature of a classical algorithm to be able to train and learn faster on quantum infrastructure.
So I know a lot of finance companies use things like Python with various libraries like pandas and other such things, and the Aura language. But when you're talking about what your company offers, you're talking about building software for processors that don't even exist yet. So how does one get ready for that or write software for that? Because I know I can get pandas. I know I can get Python.
Yeah, well, so some of the processors do exist. Okay. So your listeners today can, straight after this podcast, they can go to the IBM Quantum Experience and sign up and use a quantum computer today. It's available. We can use it. It is real hardware that does quantum computing work. It's early stage hardware and it's not particularly capable, but it's there. It's a real processor and it's accessible. And well done to the IBM team for making that available. And it's those kind of early stage systems that provide companies like ours with the opportunity to use them as test beds and tools to help us not only learn how to program a quantum computer and to build software infrastructure that can interact with that, validate simulators. And so I think simulation is a really important building block in the pathway to quantum computing because it means that you don't necessarily need access to the hardware to start to explore the possibilities of quantum computing. And you can run quantum computing algorithms on classical infrastructure and get useful solutions and understand things like performance and scalability and the kind of interactions that are needed, which then inform the hardware development. And so the early stage hardware that we've got access to today, that hardware is helping us to validate the simulation systems that we're building so that we know that the simulators are accurately representing what's possible on a quantum computer, and we can try out different techniques on that. And so one of the key building blocks of what we build at QBranch is a quantum computing simulator. On top of that is a developer environment that allows software engineers and computer scientists that don't have any background in quantum physics or quantum information science to pick up the tools of quantum computing in languages that they're used to using and in environments they're used to using, like Python and C++, and to access libraries and tools and infrastructure that is very familiar to them, and then test out those ideas and get used to what quantum computing might offer in a simulation environment. And so that'll be a fairly common refrain over the next couple of years until we see broad-scale adoption of quantum computing in the cloud, that simulation environments and developer environments like that will become more and more accessible and more useful for the regular software engineer at an enterprise that wants to drive their solution harder and faster than before.
So you're saying right now, if I were to use your software, I would write my my own software in something like Python, C++,
yep,
and then it would run on simulators or emulators. Is that the case?
Yeah, that's exactly right. So, and the work that we've done with the Commonwealth Bank of Australia in Sydney is a great example where P is in Python and you interact with it in a regular solution environment and software development environment that's very familiar to a Python user. And then to test that algorithm, you've got access to a simulation environment that mimics the behavior of quantum computing hardware so that you can get into that developer cycle of build, test, debug, fix, build, test, debug, fix, and gradually improve that solution and understanding of the performance characteristics.
When the time comes and the real systems are out there, how easy is it for you to take whatever they've written and not send it to the simulator, but send it to the real processor?
Well, that's certainly the dream. That's what we're aiming for, is that if you've built your application in a simulation environment and you've validated that there is a viable solution, being able to, for want of a better word, sort of compile it down to a particular target hardware. So if you're working with the IBM infrastructure and you test that within our developer environment, it should, and this is what we've got to build, it should just work. You should be able to compile it to particular hardware targets. And so that's the challenge that we have over the next couple of years in building out these solutions, is to work with the hardware folks to make sure that that we can build those compilers and those systems that can interact with their hardware, and it just works on the day. So there's a lot of work to go in that space.
But I imagine, you know, this is early days, and are we likely to have the case where the Amazon quantum computing language is different than the IBM one, is different than the Microsoft one, is different than the Google one, and you will have to kind of merge the get them all work together?
Yeah, so every quantum computing hardware developer is building their own abstraction stack away from their hardware that allows you to control and to interact with it. And each hardware developer is emphasizing different things and building systems that support their particular approach. There are many ways to build a quantum computer. We don't know yet which is the best way, or if there will be, and as we expect, there'll be many winners in this space. There'll be different levels of abstraction that get created for each particular hardware system and different approaches to building that. So there will be quite a bit of difference, we expect, particularly in the early days, on the way that we interact with different hardware systems, just depending on the design choices that those manufacturers make. And so that's part of the challenge, and part of what we offer as a software company is helping to bridge that gap between the different layers of abstraction and the different approaches that people take in quantum computing.
Michael, any final notes before we wrap up for the evening?
Yeah, so I think QBranch is a growing company. We're always looking for exceptional talent to join our team. So if people are interested in this technology and are passionate about creating something that has never existed before and want to be involved in that journey, then we are hiring. So check out our website at www.qxbranch.com and the jobs that are listed there. We're also we're giving a presentation in early May in Washington, D.C. on the relationship between machine learning and quantum computing at Georgetown University. So if you Google that, welcome.
I can include
a
link
along
as well in the podcast notes if you send that on to me.
Oh, that'd be great. And throughout this year, we'll be doing a number of quantum computing hackathons as well, and introducing people to the world of quantum computing in a sort of one day, easy to access environment where we sort of teach people quantum computing 101. We give them some challenges of increasing difficulty, and by the time people walk out at the end of the day, they've programmed a couple of quantum computing applications. And so we'll be running those in the US, UK, and Australia throughout the rest of this year. So if you type quantum computing hackathon into Google, you'll find a couple of those.
And then the hiring, are you hiring in the US or hiring somewhere else?
Yeah, so QBranch is Washington, D.C. area. We're hiring here. We also have a team in Australia. We'll be hiring principally software engineering talent there. And in the UK, we've got a project that's in partnership with UBS Investment Bank in the UK and supported by the Innovate UK program. And we're currently staffing up that project in London. So we're certainly keen to meet people that have software engineering skills, not necessarily quantum information science, but of course we'd love to meet you. But high quality software engineers is what we need at QBranch.
Michael Brett, thank you very much for your time this evening.
It's been a pleasure, Brian. Thanks very much.
If you like this episode, you might also like episode 82 with Jay Gambetta on the IBM Quantum Experience, or episode 68 with Michael Biersik on quantum computing more broadly. The opening music was Return by Nisi23 from the album 11 and 12, and the closing music was American Widgeon by Chad Crouch from the album Birdwatching Piano Preludes.